is Cheryl Fusco Johnson on Writer's Voices. I'm the guest host today for Monica Hadley and her mom, Carolyn, who aren't with us. But we do have with us, I'm excited to report, Enola Pickett, an author from Kansas City, who has a new novel coming out. I believe it's about April 8th. That book is going to come out from Cedar Fort. It's called Wasatch Summer. Hello, Enola. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Cheryl. Thank you.
It's so nice to have you here. And I just finished reading your book last night, and I really enjoyed it a lot.
Oh, thanks. I'm glad you did.
So why don't you tell readers a little about what the book is about and how you stumbled upon the story?
Well, actually, I guess it was about 4 years ago. I was visiting a friend in California, and we went out to dinner with some friends of hers. And on the way to the restaurant, for some reason, one of her friends told a story about his grandmother who, in 1889, when she was only 8 years old, she had to take the family sheep up into the mountains above Cache Valley in Utah for summer grazing because the sheep can't stay down where the crops are growing because they'll eat them all up. But she had to go all by herself. And it just amazed me that a child that young would have that kind of responsibility. And it just, the story stuck with me, and I did some research. And actually, I found out that it wasn't an unusual story that at that time, especially in that part of the country, many young children had to do similar things.
And this would interest you particularly because you had been a children's writer already and an educator. Tell us a little bit about your background.
Well, I'm the oldest of six, so I've got a lot of experience with younger brothers and sisters. And we're spread out. My youngest sister is 19 years younger than I am. And I taught school for a long time. I was a children's librarian. I just have always liked kids. And I have one of my own, which, of course, is very nice. He's not a little child anymore, but he read a lot. And so I had a lot of experience from the other side as a reader, reading children's literature to my child. And it just fascinated me. And I when I was in college, I majored in English and creative writing. But I really wasn't writing for children. That came later.
But you had done some other published works before Wasatch Summer, is that right?
Yes, I have a chapter book called Old Enough for Magic for young readers and an educational book on the multiple intelligences for teachers.
So that was sort of a craft book or an activity book for the classroom?
Well, it's a combination of theory and practice, and it combined exercises and things that teachers could do with classes that would emphasize life skills such as perseverance or flexibility, and also tie in with the multiple intelligences.
And multiple intelligences means different learning styles?
Well, sort of. It's that kids have different strengths, and we tend to, in schools, to basically to test kids according to their language skills and math. And some kids have really strong intelligences in other areas, like visual or bodily kinesthetic. Dancers, athletes have great intelligence in that area. I think when the theory first came out by Gardner, I think there were eight. I think he's got it up to 10 or maybe 11 now.
So give us an idea. What was the title of that book in case people are interested in reading more about?
It's Multiple Intelligences and Positive Life Skills.
Okay. Now, was your chapter book also a nonfiction book, the book on magic, or was that a story?
No, it was a story about a little boy whose older sister tells him he's not old enough for magic when he gets a magic set for his birthday. And it turns out she's the one who's not old enough for magic because she doesn't read the directions, and she turns herself into a frog.
Oh, that sounds fun.
And he has to figure out how to turn her back.
So you'd had experience before writing fiction, and you'd done a lot of magazine work, too, is that right?
Uh-huh. I've even written confession stories.
That really surprises me, just because I know you. I've known Enola for quite a while. So.
Well, they're not bodice rippers. They're mostly funny.
Oh, that doesn't surprise me, because you do have a sense of humor. let's get back to this story. So you had stumbled on this story by going out to dinner, and your friend's uh-huh. grandmother had at eight had to go alone up into the country. So how did you go about researching this topic in order to write about it?
Well, one of the first things, like, she was a Mormon, which is not surprising since it's set in 19th century Utah. The first thing I did was go to the Mormon Visitor Center here. It's in Independence, right next to Kansas City. And the young woman who greeted me at the door, it turned out, was from Cache Valley, which is the site of the story. So I sort of took that as a sign that I should really pursue this book. And I did some initial research there, and I found some primary documents, diaries, written by Mormon women at the Genealogy Center in Independence. So that kind of started me on paper. And then, since sheep were involved, I know nothing about sheep, so I went online and I found someone at Idaho State University, who referred me to a sheep herder in Utah, and so I had that connection, and so I actually went out to Cache Valley.
And you went and met the sheep herder?
Yeah, actually, I shouldn't call him a sheep herder. He owns, like, thousands of sheep, but he was the man who gave me the information about.
So how did that work? Did you just email him or call him?
Well, I did email him. At that time, he didn't have email. I wrote him a letter because the professor at the university gave me his address, and I wrote him a letter, and he wrote back and said he'd be glad to talk to me if I came out. So then we set up a way to meet kind of out on the road.
In Utah.
It's in Utah, yeah.
So I think that's kind of interesting how you went about your research, because a lot of people are a little intimidated about researching, and also I think many people just beginning to do fiction writing don't realize that any research is necessary.
Well, yeah, I think that the second part is true. And the first part was true for me. You know, it's kind of ironic that I'm doing this interview by phone, because I really don't like talking on the phone. And I'm always, sometimes when people call the house, they ask to speak to my mother, because I guess I sound younger than I am. I'm not very young. Anyway, I digress. You do have to make contact with people if you're writing historical fiction, especially.
Well, one of the things I liked a lot about your book is it just seemed so visceral and so real. You mentioned buttons, and buttons are a continuing theme.
Yeah.
Why don't you explain a little to listeners what that tradition with buttons is among the...
Now, this was something I found from visiting the Pioneer Museum in Salt Lake City. The Mormons are wonderful because they have pioneer museums in all the little towns, and they have, you know, they really do a good job of keeping their history alive and family stories. But I saw this, it's called a button string, and it just intrigued me. I saw more than one, and so I researched it online and found out that it was a Victorian custom for girls. I don't know exactly what to compare it to today, but the idea was that you kept buttons that people either gave you or traded, and you put them on a string. And the theory was, I don't know if anybody actually accomplished this, but you were supposed to get 999 buttons, and then your true love would bring the 1,000th button.
So I guess those Victorian men knew the tradition.
carried
instead of like
and
the diamond
two
ring.
Buttons could be alike, which amazes me. I don't know how you could accumulate that many buttons that would all be different.
Oh, I had no idea that was part of the tradition. Now, this tradition wouldn't have been restricted just to Mormons then. It was a widespread. I'd heard of that before, but I like the way you described throughout your story, there's that thread of the string of buttons, and there's, you know, a dramatic part where the buttons are lost, the string is lost, and, the, you know, the little girl sort of counts on that string for comfort. But one of the things I liked was you mentioned, for example, a tortoise shell button, and that when she would touch it and she could smell the turtle or the tortoise?
Yeah, apparently that button doesn't smell very good if you rub it.
So. How did you find that out?
It was in some written research that I saw all the different kinds of buttons, and I guess I looked at some research about the different kinds, and I found out that the tortoise shell, if you rub it or if you get it wet, smells really awful.
Well, that makes sense, because I remember having turtles when I was little before that was a banned activity. You know, kids always had these little turtles, and they did kind of have a strong, fishy sort of aquatic smell. But I think that's the kind of detail that makes your story really feel like it, you know, it happened, that people can understand. Now, the little girl in Wasatch Summer, and I just want to remind listeners that we're talking to Enola Pickett, and she's an author from Kansas City. She has just had a new children's book come out called Wasatch Summer. But the little girl in your story, Hannah, is actually 10. Explain how that happened, that instead of 8, you had a 10-year-old.
I just felt that the story was too complex for really young readers. And kids usually like to read about someone a little older than them. And I felt if I made the girl 8, that she wouldn't appeal to like readers who were even 8, you know, because kids generally like to read about someone just a little older. And I thought even 10 would be amazing for kids today to think of, you know, having to do that by themselves. So I made her a little older. That's what authors can do.
So, and of course, I'm sure there were children, all the children who were doing this weren't 8. It was just such an unusual thing.
Yeah.
And then the narrative voice could be a little bit more complex because an 8-year-old would be, you know, quite a bit different than a 10-year-old. So
that, and her reflections on things and, I just felt it fitted the book better for her to be older.
I really felt that it reminded me of the Laura Ingalls Wilder books. It really had that, you know, feeling of people against the elements, and in this case it was a little girl against the elements. And one thing I noticed is you were very straightforward about the hardships that this family faced, that the father had died, the brother had gone to try to earn money from the family working in a mine and just suddenly wasn't heard from anymore. The family had lost a lot of babies. You know, the mother had quite a few children, but I think at least 4 of them died at birth in the past. So how do you feel about, you know, presenting children with the world as it is?
Well, I think we underestimate children. I think they know a lot more about the real world than we think they do sometimes. But I also think it's good for them to know that in years gone by, babies did die and parents die. I mean, the parents dying is nothing new. That happens to kids today. Either they die or leave. I don't see a problem with it. I think they know and understand more than sometimes we think they do.
And particularly with historical fiction, I mean, this is what was happening.
Yeah.
And, you know, that is the reason that these really young children had to go out. And so how long was your character alone with the sheep?
You mean in the book? Or?
Right, yeah, in the book or in real life. Or, I mean, why don't you tell us about
that? Well, it was basically, you know, 3 months, a summer. Although in the book, as in real life, she was befriended by some Blackfeet Indians. That was the other part of the story that intrigued me.
I also want to just remind listeners, this is KRUU 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa and beyond, and you're listening to Writers' Voices. This is Cheryl Fusco Johnson sitting in for Monica Hadley, the regular host, and with me today is Enola Pickett, the author of Wasatch Summer. And exactly when is your book coming out?
April 8th.
Yeah. Yeah, well, to stir up some excitement here among our listeners, would you care to read a little?
Sure. Why don't I read part of the chapter where she finds out what she has to do for the summer, because she's planning. Her brother Caleb has always been the one that's taken the sheep up, and she's been wondering who's going to do it, because Caleb, they haven't heard from Caleb, but it has never occurred to her that it would be herself. So here we go. All through May, something worrying hung in the air. Nothing seemed to please Mama. She even snapped at baby Alice. My mother and Uncle John took to talking every evening after supper. When I come near, they'd fall quiet. I was walking back from the barn one evening when I heard my uncle. Elizabeth, there's no other way. Mama's voice cracked. This will end with me losing another part of my family. I ran to my tree swing and pushed myself through the warm breeze. What did Mama mean about losing part of her family? Was Catherine sick? Baby Alice? Mama's call interrupted my questions. Hannah, come inside. Your uncle and I want to talk to you. Hurry now. I dragged my feet against the hard ground to stop the swing, dreading whatever waited for me. Life without Papa and Caleb left a hole that had filled up with sadness and extra work. Was there room for one more misery? What are you doing out there? Mama's voice snapped my mind to attention. I'm coming. I trudged toward the house, but then I spotted a little green lizard I'd seen yesterday by the pump. It skittered across the ground and disappeared under a thistle plant. I poked the leaves with a stick, trying to coax it out again. Hannah, turn or stop your lollygagging. Mama's voice sounded plumb worn out. The air inside our farmhouse hung heavy and serious. Mama's mouth thinned into a tight line, and her long fingers picked at her apron. Uncle John looked straight ahead, his face stern and set. My heart lurched. What's wrong? I sank into my rocker and stared at the pink roses trailing across the wallpaper. You tell her, John, Mama said. Every part of me, teeth to toes, clenched into knots. Uncle John frowned. It's near time to take the sheep up to the summer range, and Caleb's still away. I nodded. I'd been wondering who'd take his place with the sheep. Your uncle will work our fields along with his own, Mama said, plant our crops and care for the livestock. We need extra help from you, Hannah. I already did the milking and washing up. I fed our animals and gathered eggs, helped with the cooking and tended to my sisters, emptied the chamber pots every morning. What else could I do? I'll weed the vegetable garden, Mama, I said. I swallowed hard and added a chore that I sorely disliked. I'll even beat the carpets. My uncle shook his head. We need you to do more. I studied the wallpaper roses. What more could I do? Mama's voice sounded hoarse, like she had a bad cold. There's no other way. You'll take the sheep up for summer grazing. I gasped. Tend the herd? Alone with the sheep and with the dogs and sheep? Instead of a summer at home, I'd have months of loneliness in the mountains above Cache Valley. It was too much. I can't manage that by myself, I protested. There's no one else, Mama said. We can't lose our sheep. We need them for our livelihood. Her voice was thin as sewing thread. Tending them in the high country will be the same as down here. But it won't be the same, I said. I won't have family in the mountains. You'll be down here. If something goes wrong, you can't help me. I've never been away from Sago Springs except to visit Grandma Swenson's farm a few miles away. Now I faced a whole summer with no friends, no sweet little sisters. Worst of all, I'd be without Mama. I'd be alone. So that's when she finds out she's got to take the sheep up.
Well, that was really a wonderfully written, wonderfully crafted scene, I felt, where you really capture the emotion of how frightening this would be for a child who's only 10 years old to be separated for 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
From, especially since she has lost her father and brother recently. You know,
right.
I don't know where the brother is. And so how hard was it for you to craft that scene?
Well, it was a little hard because I felt so sorry for her. But I think that helped me get into how she really felt, get into her emotions and her shock at this news.
Yeah, I thought that you did a lot of different things. You had her protesting, which seems like in that era, disagreeing with your elders, you know, that was probably a pretty dramatic thing for her to say, no, it wouldn't be the same, you know, as down here. So that was one of the things. And then you also had some of her thoughts, so we could hear her thinking. So you had some interior monologue. And then the mother's voice, I think you described it two or three times, like sometimes the mother's voice was hoarse, and sometimes it was thin like the sewing thread.
Yeah.
So I thought you really conveyed through showing, which is, you know, what writers are often...
what we hope to do, yeah.
Yeah, so what we're told to do. So that was a very poignant scene, I felt. And then, you know, the dramatic events just go on from there. So she's up in the mountains, and then... so she does encounter some people up there. Do you want to tell us just a little about who she encounters?
Well, the first morning, her Uncle John... this is part of the story, and it was part of the true story. Her uncle comes up every week with supplies, so she does see him once a week. But the first morning she's there by herself, she's taken care of the sheep, she's moved them to shade, and she's kind of doing little chores around the sheep camp wagon, which is something I'd like to talk about later. She hears a horse neigh up above her, and she looks up, and there are two Indian men on horseback just looking at her. This also, by the way, was part of the true story. And she's terrified because they don't wave, they don't nod, they just look at her. And she turns away, and when she looks back again, they're gone. So she doesn't know what to think, you know, whether they're on their way down to get her or get the sheep. One of her schoolmates has told her that would probably happen, that some Indians would either steal her or the sheep. So, no, but nothing happens. So she goes through the morning, and that afternoon she sees a group of Indian women and children walking towards her. And again, she's terrified. She doesn't know, you know, why they're coming, what they're there for, what they're going to do. But it turns out that they come every day just to make sure she's all right. So they're kind of looking after her.
And did you do some research to establish that there were some good relations between settlers and Native Americans?
Yes, and actually this was part of the story that the grandmother told my friend's friend, Indians, the Blackfeet Indians. They you know, they live in Montana even at that time, but they would come down for summer camp, and they'd come down to Utah.
Well, I could see where this would motivate you even more to tell the story, because we don't hear a lot of stories of the cooperation.
No. And my editor was not totally convinced at first that they were Blackfeet, because there are a lot of Shoshone in Utah. In fact, a large group of Shoshone had converted to become Mormons. But I had also the opportunity to visit the Blackfeet Reservation in Montana, and spent some time with one of the elders there, who assured me that they even went in the summer, they would go down as far as Salt Lake to get salt for themselves.
Oh,
so she said they were Blackfeet. She just was sure. So.
Well, it sounds like you sort of enjoyed the research for this book.
Oh, I did. I met some wonderful people. I didn't come across anybody who begrudged giving me their time or their stories, or, you know, sending me on to someone who would know more than they did about something, or would have a different angle on something. Hmm. So I took two trips, one to Utah and one to Montana, and they were both wonderful.
And where did you see one of these sheep camps? Did you actually see one, what they looked like? I mean, the wagon?
I did. The sheep camp that I saw when I met the man who owned all the sheep was actually a metal one. But the original ones were canvas. And we went, my husband was with me, and we went to, I think it's Antelope Island. I'm not sure. It's in the Salt Lake. And they have, like, a farm set up the way, and a ranch the way things used to be. And they had one there. So I got to see the real thing.
So that sounds sort of like Living History Farms in Iowa. So it's
yeah, exactly. And they were called sort of the precursor to the kind of campers people have.
Like metal campers that people drive on the road.
Uh huh.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, they kind of have the feel of a covered wagon, in that they're canvas stretched over a frame, but there's a bunk bed at one end, and there's a cook stove. There's a little chimney coming out of the canvas roof, and there's a drop-down table. I mean, it's very efficiently arranged.
Were you able to actually get inside it, or is it sort of roped off and you look at it?
I stepped up, but I couldn't get all the way in, but I could see it. It's very clever the way they have hooks and things on the outside, like to hang brooms and wash tubs. And there are storage bins underneath that you can open out and put your flour and things in.
So did you take a lot of notes and then take a lot of pictures of this so that when you went home, or did you, like, write in your hotel room?
I did, and in the car. And, both of us took a lot of pictures. So I had a lot of pictures of the sheep camp. And there was another living history farm outside, kind of between Salt Lake City and Logan, and there happened to be a little 8-year-old girl there who let me take some pictures of her, because meeting her, it was really hard to imagine an 8-year-old girl going up with dogs and sheep for the summer.
Now, was this little girl in costume as, you know, part of the display, or is she just a tourist?
No, she was there with her. Her family, the different families took turns at this farm, and it was their day. So she was churning some butter, and she let me take her picture.
That's cool. Yeah, it's hard when you think, like, how young 8 years is. It's just really hard to imagine.
Being
all alone for a week. But
I've talked to some school groups about it, you know, and I ask them if they have chores to do. Well, yeah, you know, they have to take the trash out, or they have to do the dishes. And then I tell them what the girl in the book did, and it boggles their mind.
Well, that brings me to something else I want to ask you, but first I want to do our station identification. This is KRUU 100.1 FM. You're listening to Writers' Voices. I'm Cheryl Fusco Johnson, the guest host for Monica Hadley, who is not with us today, but with us is Enola Pickett, who has a really wonderful children's book that is coming out April 8th. It's called Wasatch Summer. It's historical fiction about a young girl who has to take on a lot of responsibilities due to tragedies that happened to her family. And it's based on a real-life event. But before I forget, Enola, you touched on that you talked to children. I saw a very interesting picture of you with a turkey wing, it looked like.
And
with a mass of, I don't know what it was, like some green plant on the desk. So it looks to me like you're doing some school visits.
Well, I did. It was on. I guess you do it in Iowa. I don't know why you wouldn't.
Well, the author visits
across America for Dr. Seuss's birthday.
Oh, right. Yeah.
So I was a guest reader, and
yeah, I got to do that one year. I went to the library, and they gave me a Dr. Seuss hat, and I got to
read. Oh, I couldn't get a hat.
Well, but you brought your own props, so tell us a little about what you brought.
Well, I'm
with
glad you asked about the turkey wing, though. One of the fun things about research is finding kind of interesting, unusual things that you can use in your book. And one thing I found out, I was reading some books that I had gotten at the Blackfeet Museum in Browning. And one of the things mentioned was that they used turkey wings for fans. And I thought, oh, that's so cool. Then I found out, doing some reading about Mormons in that time in Utah, is that they used turkey wings to dust. So I thought, that on Hannah's birthday, which takes place while she's up there, I gave her my birthday, so it's July 11th.
Oh, that's 11th. So cute. I won't forget your birthday anymore then.
It's fun. And her mother sent her a turkey wing to dust, and the Indians brought her a turkey wing fan. And when she opens her mother's gift, her Indian friends start laughing. And she's kind of offended because they think she's laughing at her mother's gift. But then they bring out their gift, which is a turkey wing that they use for fanning.
Now, when I saw this picture of you, I think, was it on your website? Is that where I probably saw it?
It's probably either there or maybe on Facebook. I can't remember.
Would you like to give listeners your website address in case they want to visit your... your publisher have a website set up?
I do. It's www.anolapicket.com.
And if listeners, if you do visit this website and see this picture, I mean, this turkey wing is enormous, which you could imagine. You know, turkeys are big. But how do they keep this turkey wing from decomposing? I mean, it was huge. It was like the size of a bed pillow or something. I mean, it looked really big in the picture.
It is large. And I that was kind of another interesting journey, I guess, trying to find a turkey wing. And I mentioned it to several people who I thought would know someone who hunts, and but I didn't get any turkey wings. So I went online, and I just Googled turkey wings, and I found a source where you can order a turkey wing. And it's just the feathers with a little piece of the joint attached. So I ordered one.
And it just holds together? Then you pick it up by the...
But it came the next day, and I couldn't figure out how it got there so fast. Well, it's from... a business in Chillicothe, which is probably a couple of hours from Kansas City. So that was kind of funny that I had looked all over, you know, trying to get a turkey wing, and there was one just up the road.
Well, I'm sure it makes a really dramatic prop when you pull that out in front of the children.
And I've got to figure out, I've got some craft directions for attaching a handle and wrapping it in leather to make it, you know, more
authentic,
like a fan. But the joint part where the feathers are attached had been treated with, I think, borax. So
I imagine that's what the pioneers did, too, is they must have done something to preserve this.
They did.
And they had to make use of whatever they had, and it's sort of a good lesson for the kids. So I could see
that's
a wonderful prop. Now, what was the plant? It looks like you had some huge
bunch of... that just happened to be on the table at the school.
Oh, okay, because it looked like just a mass of greenery, which I thought, I don't know what, I thought you brought like sorrel.
When you said the greenery, I thought, oh, what was that? I've forgotten.
I didn't know if it was something this little girl cooked, you know, I didn't know what you were showing the kids.
There were some other fun things that I tied into the story that I connected with the Blackfeet. For instance, Hannah is noted for... not looking before she leaps. In fact, the story was called Hannah's Leap at first, but it had to be changed because there was a similar title coming out from the same publisher. And her hair has gotten very dirty. It's gotten greasy from fires and campfires, and it's been hot, and so she decides to wash her hair. And as she bends over, her brush sweeps into the little river that goes by, and
because
she can't catch it. It goes downstream. So she's left with this mat. She has very, very curly hair. She's left with this mass of tangles, and she can't comb it. She doesn't have a comb. The brush she has is gone. So the only thing she can figure out to do is just to cut her hair.
Although first she tries a fork, I seem to remember.
Uh-huh. She tries the fork. That doesn't work. So she just cuts it all off. And late that afternoon when the Blackfeet come to visit, they rush to her and ask her who died. And she doesn't understand what's going on until finally they explain that it's a custom that when someone dies, who's close to you, a spouse or a child or a parent, that many women will cut their hair off as a sign of mourning, and they think that's what's happened to her. So I tried to put little cultural things in about the Blackfeet along with information about the Mormons and sheep herding and the times themselves.
Will you be sending a copy of your book to some of these people that contributed to your research, like when you visited the Blackfeet?
Yes, and I hope to go up there with the book and talk to the children in their school, but we'll see.
Yeah, that would be great.
Yeah.
So another thing I wanted to talk to you about is your son is also a writer. Tell us a little about your son, Peter, or Jerry.
Jerry's a journalist, but he's also written novels and short stories. And he's currently living in Abu Dhabi in the United Arab Emirates. He's the editor, an editor for The National, which is the English language newspaper that the King started about 3 or 4 years ago. So he's been there for 2 years and with his wife, Kara.
And you went and visited, I believe.
We did. We went there last year about this time. And we went with them to Egypt and Jordan. And we were glad that we went this year. I mean, last year, not this year. Especially to Egypt.
Yeah, really. So, but one of the things I wanted to ask you about your son is, you're a writer, he's a writer. I'm curious if you have any tips to share with listeners who may want to develop writing ability in their own children.
Oh, that's a good question. Let me think back. Well, of course, reading is a big thing, huge thing. And we used to make up stories together, sort of cooperative storytelling. And sometimes my husband would get involved, too, but we'd take the story so far, and then, I would start, and then Jerry would do a segment, and then I'd do a segment. So we did a lot of oral storytelling. And I guess he used to see me writing, because I always had notebooks to write in. And he would make up stories and dictate them, and I'd write them down.
Oh, I did that with my son a lot, too.
Yeah, I bet you did. I remember his first poem, "A Bug Is Too Little to Play on a Fiddle."
I don't know. Do you think he'll be embarrassed that you shared that with us? I think it's pretty good. Tell us the title of, he has a mystery novel. Is that right?
He does. It's called Out of the Depths.
So that must have been a pretty exciting day when his book came out.
It was. It's kind of a horror suspense science fiction. I think they call it speculative fiction.
Are you developing any family traditions to celebrate these books that your family is having published?
Well, no, I never thought of that.
Well, you might have to start thinking of that. When you were traveling with your son in the Middle East, did you get any ideas for future stories that you might want to develop?
I did. I was fascinated by the cats in the Middle East. So I'm thinking I'd like to do some kind of a picture book about the cats of Arabia. They're everywhere.
Well, I do remember on your website also seeing maybe a sphinx and a live cat, some kind of picture like that.
I don't know if they were there together, but yeah.
Yeah, I remember you. So what was the process of having your book, you know, shepherded onto publication like? And tell us how you found your publisher, Cedar Fort.
Well, I tried to, you know how you do. You submit to editors. You try to attract an agent. And I kept being told historical fiction is not selling.
I guess everybody's thinking more about fantasy.
Yeah, I think I kind of started out when Twilight was big. I don't know. but then somebody said to me, you should try to get a Utah publisher, better yet, a Mormon publisher, because they'll really understand the story and they'll do a good job of shepherding it through, you know, the whole process of getting it published, getting it out to people. So that's where I went, and I finally found Cedar Fort. And the book is under their imprint, Bonneville Books. I think that's their children's line.
How many?
It just took a long time, and you just have to. I mean, I really believed in this story, and I loved Hannah, and I just kept pushing.
How many rejections?
Luckily, I belonged to a critique group who were very supportive, and they said, you know, just keep on, keep on. Now, I have to tell you that I did get it back from Cedar Fort with a note saying, we don't think the ending is complete. And it took me a while to figure, you know, because they didn't give me any hint about...
Where to go.
And I finally figured out what needed to happen was I needed to show Hannah coming back home because I had stopped it before she actually returned back down to Cache Valley.
Oh.
So I figured it out, and they loved it, and here now, it comes, April 8th.
April 8th. I want to remind listeners we're talking to Enola Pickett. She's a children's novelist. She's done other kinds of writing as well, but her new book, Wasatch Summer, is coming out very soon. And also, this is KRUU 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. So as you were submitting, what kept you from, was it your critique group that kept you going? How many rejection slips had you gotten for this book before you sold it?
Oh, I don't know. Many, many. I mean, I had run it. You know how you have lists, books of that list publishers.
Yeah, different market guides.
I had run that dry. And
that must have been really discouraging because so many of the publishers have merged into, mm-hmm. you know, like one big mega company.
Yeah.
It feels like there's fewer options.
It's not over. I don't think it keeps happening. And you just have to keep at it. I mean, if you want me to give some advice to writers, it's to keep at it. And believe, you know, especially if you're writing something you really believe in. And I really believed in Hannah's story. And I felt it was important for kids to know stories like this. So that kind of encouraged me to keep going. Although everybody who knows me well knows that I would get really discouraged. But you have to keep going. My husband says it's like fishing. You have to keep putting the hook in the water.
Oh, that's true. Because no matter how wonderful a story it is, if you're not making attempts to reach the publishers,
yeah.
you know, not too many people are going to be reading it.
Right.
So, and were you, I haven't seen the illustrations because I read text-only version, but are there illustrations and are you happy with them?
Oh, just the cover art.
Well, the cover art, like that I saw online, looked wonderful. It looked really good.
Yeah, I like the cover a lot. They did a nice job.
Is your publisher arranging any activities or book tours for you, or are you mostly
doing? Not that I know of at this point, but there will be.
So do you have any local things lined up in Kansas City? Is that something you're thinking about?
I am. We have a wonderful children's bookstore here called Reading Reptile. And
so an independent store?
Yes, yes. And I'm in negotiations for that to find a date. So that'll be... Check my website. It'll be there.
And you had a lot of crafts in your book. Because, mm-hmm. you know, at some point, Hannah is making presents.
Yes.
So were those things that you researched?
Yes. I had a little, it's called The Girl's Handbook from, I don't know, the 19th century. It's kind of like a Girl Scout handbook, but it's not Girl Scout. And so I got a lot of activities from there. And some of them are things that kids still do today, like making, you know, paper hats and... whirligigs.
I don't know, that might be harder to do if all the newspapers fold.
Well, that's true. That's another reason to keep those newspapers going.
So, and you can use some of those.
My son makes his living, so.
Right. So, and you can use some of those activities in your school or library visits, right?
Right. And I try to put a new activity up every month on the website. There's a link called What's Hannah Doing? And I put, you know, some kind of activity that kids would have been doing back then.
Does that scare you at all? I mean, what are you going to do when you run out of activities?
Well, I figure if I just do a month, that I can come up with 12.
Yeah, I guess, yeah. Have you thought at all about a sequel? My prediction is this is going to be a very popular book.
Well, I hope so. Well, I kind of have, yeah. I'm working on another historical fiction for middle grades right now, so I would want to get that finished before I started up on another Hannah story.
What's your current project like?
Well, it's set in 1913 on the Outer Banks, and it's about a little girl who wants to be a lifesaver. Lifesavers were the ones that would go out to the shipwrecks and rescue people.
Oh.
It's kind of the precursor to the Coast Guard. And that's what she wants to do, but of course she's a girl, so she can't. And she has some other issues in her life that her mother left when she was 3. And
how did you, you know, what interested you in this particular story and that geographical location?
Well, I love the Outer Banks. I've only been there twice, but both times we went to Ocracoke Island, which is basically a fishing village. It's never become, you know, a big, huge tourist thing. They worked hard to kind of maintain their integrity as a Outer Bank island. And I just heard a lot of stories there about the lifesavers and their rescues. And I just got sort of intrigued with that. And began developing a story. So it's not the same as Hannah. There wasn't a true story that someone told me. But I heard a lot of shipwreck stories and lifesaver stories and stories about characters that live on those islands.
Well, you must be pretty gregarious if you go, like, for a vacation. You've already told us you've only been there a couple times. So how do you hear all these stories? You just, like...
Well, National Parks people do a wonderful job. You know, they have all these programs, and that's kind of what got me started. It's basically talking to them, and then to some of the people in the shops and at the fish market, and reading. There's lots of books about quirky characters that live on the Outer Banks.
Well, you know, I do enjoy those... like park bookstores and gift shops. My husband's always trying to drag me out, but I really love looking at the collection of books that they'll have about local lore.
Mm-hmm.
And I could see where that would be kind of a treasure trove of possibilities of things to write about.
Right, right. And the And they often connect you with real people. You know, they mention somebody, or you can talk to the author, or the park ranger knows somebody. So you just kind of make connections. I don't know that I call myself gregarious, but once I get onto a story or an interesting character, I guess I do.
Tell us a little bit about the notebooks. You were telling us that your son would always see you writing in your notebooks. Were you doing journal writing, or were you, like, writing about possible story and article ideas?
Well, kind of a combination of things. I have a terrible habit of eavesdropping, and I often write down bits of conversation I hear. In fact, my husband has even been known to trade places with me in a restaurant because there's a more interesting conversation going on his side of the table.
He will instigate that? He'll say, oh, Enola, wouldn't you like to trade places with me? And then you know what that means?
That only happened once, but he did do it. It was very thoughtful of him because it was a parent and child conversation. I can't remember what it was about, but it was interesting.
So do you have a bunch of notebooks?
I found descriptions of characters I see.
How do you retrieve that stuff?
I just go through the notebooks. I don't know how many boxes of notebooks I have. In fact, we had a flood in our basement last summer.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
And quite a few things got mildewed, but I put them out in the sun. I don't want to give them up.
I'm just curious because I know a lot of I do a little bit of journal writing, but not a lot. But I know people who have done it for years and years, and I'm very curious about how they then, like, is just the process of writing it down enough that later when you're thinking about a character, you can kind of remember what you wrote down? Or do you actually thumb through your journals every so often to see if you have some good material in there?
Well, if it ties into something pretty quickly that I'm working on, I can retrieve it from my memory. And it dawned on me, I guess within the last year, that it would be really smart to date my journals because I didn't used to do that. And I don't have them in any kind of order, so it's kind of this journey into my past to pick up a notebook and...
Oh, to try to find the one you're looking for.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's pretty hopeless sometimes.
So it's sort of serendipity.
It's serendipitous. Yeah. I open it up and there's, I could use this. Or, I remember that. So, I don't know. I'm not very organized about my notebooks, but I'm getting better.
Well, the important thing is that you're organized enough that you have come up with some finished projects and you have this wonderful book, Wasatch Summer, coming out very soon. We've both done some teaching. I mean, we have some teaching in common. And I'm curious if you have some tips for writers, what they can do to develop the perseverance to bring a project through to completion, or what they can do, like any tips about how writers can improve their productivity or the quality of their writing, or both.
Productivity, that depends so much on where you are in your life and what's going on. I guess I'm thinking especially of women because we have so many demands on our time. But if you can manage to write every day, even if it's just a little bit, I think that kind of keeps the juices flowing, and you don't lose track of what you're doing. I've had times in my life when I couldn't get back to my writing for a while, and I would kind of lose the voice or the momentum of what I had been writing. So if you can write every day, it's very helpful.
Is that what you do now?
Pardon me?
Is that what you do now? Do you try to write every day?
Yes. Yes, I do.
So what's your routine like? Are you one of those people that gets
up? I'm working on it. I have to, stop and go fix dinner or talk to my husband. I want it. And I was telling somebody yesterday, another writer, that I love this character I'm working with so much now that when I'm trying to read somebody else's book, I keep thinking about her name is Primmy. I keep thinking about Primmy, and it's distracting me from, you know, something that I really wanted to read.
Huh, interesting.
So that's kind of unusual.
And Primmy is the one that's going to be in your Outer Banks story.
Right, right.
Do you have a working title for that book?
Whisper Island.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah. Her name really is Primrose Estella, but she's really Primmy. She's definitely Primmy.
Will you be doing more research this summer for that book? Do you think you'll make another trip?
Oh, I hope so.
What does your husband think of gearing your family trips to your research projects?
Yeah, yeah.
He's okay with that?
Oh, yes. Yeah. So there was you asked me a two-part question, and I can't remember what the other one was.
Productivity and technical skill.
Oh.
Yeah, how writers can improve their writing technique.
Yeah, you have to be willing to revise. I think when you start out writing, it's hard. Once you finish something, you're finished, you're done, and you're not. You have to revise and revise and revise and realize that what you're going to come out with at the end is going to be really much, much, much better.
How much revision did you do on Wasatch Summer?
I would say I did at least 8 drafts, and then when I started working with an editor, I revised. And the thing about the ending, at first threw me, and then you have to be willing to listen to what other people say to you.
Did your critique group help you come up with a new ending when the editor wasn't satisfied with the old one?
You know, they didn't exactly, but a couple of weeks before that, somebody in the group had gone to a workshop that talked about the hero's journey.
Oh, yeah.
And that, the hero goes out but always comes back. And it took me a couple of weeks to process that, and I thought, that's what's missing. She doesn't come back. She's learned a lot of stuff, and she's changed, but she hasn't come back to where she started.
Yeah, that was insightful. Well, I think...
Yeah, it's just a combination of happenstances that the writer, Sue, came to the critique group with this workshop summary and told us about the hero's journey, and it took me a couple of weeks to realize that that's what I was needing.
Well, I think that's a good point, that sometimes you can't make those revisions too quickly. So you had to have some time after you got the word from your editor. But speaking of time, our time is about up.
I know. I can't believe it.
It was really fun to be able to spend this hour with you, and I want to remind listeners that we've been hearing Enola Pickett talk about her new book. Would you say the title for me? Because I'm not sure about Wasatch, how you say that.
Wasatch
Summer, which will be coming out on April 8th, and you can also visit her website. And thank you for talking with us today, Enola.
You're welcome. Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Bye now.
Bye.
Writer's Voices is hosted, produced, and engineered by Monica Hadley, Caroline Kilborn, Cheryl Fusco-Johnson, and Corey Hickenbottom. Archives are available at KRUUFM.com and writersvoices.com. Writer's Voices is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa.